What's going on, pal? Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you.
When's your cutoff
Yeesh.
for when you wish people a Happy New Year? Am I too late now, being the 13th of January?
No, I was thinking, I feel like it's February. That's when it's like, okay, it's over, you know, but January, I feel like it's the first month of the year. It feels like it's kind of like the birthday, you know?
Yeah, and people are still nice. People are still going to the gym. They still have their resolution, so it's still okay.
Exactly.
Hey, I really appreciate you coming on. Are you tired of all the interviews yet?
No, I mean it's the most wonderful feeling in the world to write things, and I like have he's like my imaginary friend, and to have all these people like obsessed with him now, I'm thrilled, you know, thrilled.
So you're that famous author who wrote You and Hidden Bodies. It's incredible to talk to you.
Yes, that's me.
You're
I'm
a
like sitting on my couch in my messy home.
You're a Cape Cod girl growing up. Do you ever just pinch yourself and say, wow, what a rookie debut I had that my first book just blew up like this? Do you pinch yourself?
Oh yeah, about 100 times a day. I mean, I can never get over it. You know, it's wild. It's really, really wild because it always feels like you're lucky if your mom reads it, you know?
Well, I think you shouldn't be doing podcasts now because my wife and all my friends said you should be writing book three. What are you doing chatting with me on a Monday night? You should be writing the third book. That's what everybody wants you to do right now.
You know, tell your wife that she's absolutely right, but that's where these things help me get my ass in gear because it's like if I want to go around and talk about myself and the show and the books, then you know what? I gotta write the books.
Any pressure at all to live up to the hype of the first two books and, of course, the Netflix show?
They're like, yeah, I mean, there are moments of it. It's kind of like writing in a new world where I'm like, I get those little waves of, oh my God, like this is, you know, now there are all these people that want this. But at the end of the day, writing for me is like got no choice to like shut everything off and get into it and get in flow. And it is the best feeling when I'm just kind of in it, you know?
Take me back to the Cape. Was it author or bus for you growing up? That was it. I'm an author and that's all I'm going to be.
Well, I wanted to be a solid gold dancer, but I was a little too young. I wanted to be, there's something in my diary that's like, I would like to be a model, actress, slash lawyer, slash hairdresser. Like, I. And then in all seriousness, I really did always write stories, and it kind of started with my dollhouse and my Barbies of loving to make up stories and put them in these horrible predicaments. I always loved to be scared. And then when I was in high school, I wrote a short story and I entered it in a fiction contest and I won a typewriter, and it was this very good boost like of positive reinforcement. So then I just kept writing, writing, writing. I always wrote a lot of short stories, like no matter what I was doing.
I love
Do that.
having authors. I have a lot of authors on, a lot of athletes on, different celebrities, and I always love their daily routine. So athletes, they're running, they're working out. A lot of the authors, do you make it a thing, a daily habit to write every day? Is there something you do every day as an author?
You know, it's my favorite, not, you know, it's something I love about cell phones, that having that notepad, I've always had terrible handwriting, and in the past I didn't like to like pull out a notepad and a pen and deal with it, and then I could never read what I said anyway. But I love a notepad because in the phone, because it's right there, so I can be like at the coffee shop and I think of something or I overhear something that makes me think about something and just start writing, and it looks like you're texting and it doesn't like disrupt the world. And I love that kind of writing every day, but I don't set a rule like I have to get this many pages done a day. Because for me, I think for most writers, you're doing it all the time. Like you're that when you're on deadline, when your book is moving around in your head, it's just always there. So there's a lot of thinking time, and I feel like that's just as important as the writing time.
I hate to do this to you, but where'd the idea of Joe come from? And I hate the generic hacky questions, but I have to set the platform
No,
for
I
the
get it.
podcast. So how did the idea of Joe come about? And you, how'd that even come about? Because it's a dark series to begin with. And
Yeah.
how'd you even come up with that?
So I did go through, I had a couple of very, very difficult years where my father had bladder cancer and I went home to help my mom take care of him. And it was like we knew he was going to die. And it was a, two painful, painful years of spending time in hospitals, seeing like you see the worst and the best like every day when you're in a hospital and on these middle of the night trips and these monitoring pills, and to watch someone lose all of everything like so slowly. And at the same time, my mom had some health issues and was having surgeries. And there was this one day I remember in Boston where they were in different wings of the same hospital, and I'm running back and forth. And all of that time, I feel like this voice was building in me because you would just get really for personal reasons than on behalf of other people. Like you see someone alone in a room screaming and no one's with them, just like being so emotional in so many different ways. And then after he passed away, I felt like this was like this turning moment in my life of like trying to get back to life, but also not having his voice and his teasing me and pushing me and everyone in my family, my brother, like we all just missed him a lot. And I feel like Joe's voice was my warped substitute for my dad's voice. And I feel like it sounds weird because of what the book is, but it was like, I need to invent something to pull myself out of the muck, to make us all laugh and get, you know, feel alive again and hooked on something. And he, you know, it was one of those things. He was always like, you got to keep writing, you got to keep writing. And then it became really addictive and compulsive for me. Like I just loved everything about this voice and how disturbing it was to me and how full of contradictions it was. So, because to me, like the central, like so much of the book is about loneliness and in a dark way. But I feel like when you get to, not get to, but you know, when it works out that, you know, you're losing someone very slowly. On the one hand, you have to keep telling yourself, I'm lucky. Like I know what this time is. I get to say goodbye. Like so many people don't get to say goodbye, and you have to keep fighting the self-pity. And it's like everything in art, I feel like it goes through that filter and then you make it into your own sick thing. And then who knows how that happens? Like a lot of it, like all the TV and the music references, all these things that I love. So it was like this warm, fuzzy place for me to be like, oh my God, like I can write about Prince and Pitch Perfect and all this stuff that I love that I feel like wouldn't, that makes life better even when it's awful. So there's a very long-winded answer.
No. The comparison everyone gives is Ted Bundy / Dexter, especially how good looking Joe is on TV and how the girls love him even though he's a killer. What was your, when you're writing the book, did you have a, you know, maybe a model who you thought it was going to be after or something like that?
It really did change like every day, all day. I mean, I would go into a store and see a barista and be like, oh, that's Joe. And I would like look at pictures from Taxi Driver. Oh, that's Joe. Like it was so all over the place because it was really about how this guy perceives himself more than how he looks for me. But of course, like I knew basic things about him, but it was also personality. And I'd hear someone in something and look over like, oh, that sounds like him. It was wonderful. Like it was this big, you know, pot like of stirring all of these things into it at all times. And there are certain sections of the book where I'm like, oh, yeah, this is when he's this one and this is when he's that one. Yes.
You release the book. When do you know it's a hit? When's that moment like you're welcome to the big leagues moment? Like, oh, my God, this book's a hit.
For me, like it's you release a book and then it's very quiet. And it's one of those things friends had told me, like as I was getting closer to release, like, you know, you feel like, oh, my book is out. The world changed. And then the world goes on and like everyone just goes about their business. But then let's see, my book was out September 30th of 2014. And then a couple of months later, it was December and I was in the Beverly Center. I'd been really sick and I was like trying to get Christmas presents. And then Stephen King tweeted about the book. And that was a moment that felt really like life altering because, I mean, of course, I love him my entire life. And my dad was obsessed with him. And it was one, like so many of his books are like tied to chapters in my life. And I wouldn't be the writer I am without his books. And here he was, knowing that he'd read it and felt compelled to say something about it was just like mind blowing. And that was a moment of like, OK, wow, this is wow.
Does he follow you on Twitter?
I don't think so. I don't know. I don't think so. I feel like I would know if he did, but I follow him.
Because you know what? I have a bunch of like celebrities and like high profile people that follow me. And then once they start following me, I'm like, oh, let me make sure I put good tweets out there. Like, I don't want to disappoint them. So I was wondering if he followed you, would you like still tweet randomly?
You know, Twitter is so funny that way because I try not to look at that list too much because I'm not a very good person on Twitter in the sense that like, I feel like I'm not good at one-liners. I'm not good at living my life on Twitter in that way. And also because of writing the Joe books, like I can't explain it, but it makes me feel uncomfortable about that too. Like I have this voice in my head that's always like, oh, shut up. Like you already retweeted something about yourself 5 minutes ago. Like put it away, you know, like...
The first book and the Netflix show, you, the bookstore reminds me personally of downstairs at the Strand in the East Village in New York City. I live around the corner from there. Was that the model?
Oh, you do?
Yes.
Oh, wow.
The model maybe? The old creaky bookstore vintage? Was that like, or was just a random bookstore that you thought of?
Oh, I feel like I can smell it when you say that.
Oh, isn't it the greatest place ever?
Yes, it is. Yes. Yes. So I grew up on Cape Cod, and I had a lot of retail jobs. And one of my favorite jobs was at a used bookstore that was on Main Street in little, like, quaint downtown Hyannis. And we had this basement that was huge, and there were probably, like, I'm bad at numbers, but, like, thousands of books. And they're, like, old magazines. Like, just, it was amazing. It was like the hull of a ship, you know, and just whoosh with books. So I kind of based it a little bit on that. But physically, I was thinking of all those tiny New York bookstores like the Strand that I love. And it was like, again, not very good visually in my head. It was one of those things in the first draft. My editor's like, you got to describe this cage, you know, and I'm like, yeah, well, I don't have one of those. Fortunately, I made up that part.
Oh, I'm so excited. And when I first, like, you know, saw it, I'm like, oh my God, this is the Strand. The downstairs is the Strand, like with the rare books and the true crime books. Like, I got so excited. That was my favorite part of seeing it. But we're talking a little bit about Joe in the background. Just give the quick synopsis of the book / Netflix show Joe that everyone knows about, but just give the quick synopsis of it.
I always do it. I'll just say, like, I usually start out by saying, so it's about this guy that works in a bookstore and he's really sensitive. And he's a reader and he falls in love with this girl and she uses a credit card and it goes from there that he perceives this as a flirt. And so he proceeds to, like, kind of stalk her and surprise her. And then he starts killing off the people that are in her way and ruining her life. And then people, like, whenever I say that first part, like, I was in an Uber a couple weeks ago and the guy's like, wait, you mean the show about the murder? I'm like, yeah. Because for me, like, the hook of it is that he's not hungry for blood, like in both the show and the books. Like, he's not sitting there like, ah, I miss the taste of flesh and I want to kill people. He really does feel cornered into doing it. And that doesn't mean that that's an accurate description of what he does. But for me, did you know the movie The Big Chill?
Yes.
There's a line of that, like, stayed with me every day writing every book. And since I was a kid, where he says that he couldn't get through the day without at least one juicy rationalization. And I'm like, that's Joe for me. And that's where, like, what I'm always thinking about is how he manipulates everything in his head so that he's some kind of hero.
You nailed it perfect, because not just watching the show, I always obviously like the books better, of course, and I'm sure you do too. Reading it, he's likable because he wants to just be a good guy, live. You know what? He thinks of a guy. I always think of him like being on Cape Cod at a small little cottage, just him and the girl. Like, I think he'd be happy that way with a book by a fireplace with a pipe. That's how he doesn't want to be a bad guy.
He doesn't want to be. But yeah, it's an awful world and people can be terrible. And that for me was like the interesting difference between, like, when you're writing about all of this awful, petty human behavior, which I feel like because of our times, we're all exposed to a lot more because of the nature of how communication has changed. And when you compare how easy it's become to hurt someone and say something cruel to someone to the act of murder. I was interested in, like, the interplay between these two things, you know?
I love the fact that you made the book current. And what I mean by that is you took chances, because not many books today throw Twitter and Facebook and Instagram comments on it. Was there any hesitations about doing that? Because I thought that was, like, a big risk, and I love that.
You know, of course, part of it for me in the beginning was, like, I've written a couple of unpublished, like, self-conscious books where I always wrote short stories that would always have common references and take place in our immediacy. And I could never do that. Somehow when I went to write a book, I turned into this, like, it was raining that night and like this other version of me. And I was very much like, you know what? Screw it. Like, this is what comes naturally to me. So I'm just going to be myself and write, like, the way that feels right to me. And if it's awful and, like, Facebook is out of business when this comes out, well, then it's a time capsule and here it is, you know, like, because it was too difficult for me to try and make it, you know, to omit things that I think about all the time and that fascinate me, you know.
When you started the book, did you know, one, it was going to be a trilogy or maybe a fourth book, or was it a one book deal for you?
When I started writing, halfway through, I was already, like, making notes on my phone for the next book. Like, okay, like, this is Goldilocks. And of course, after New York, he has to go to LA. And you dream of getting to write more and more and more. And then I got a two book deal. So I did with the first book. So I decided to write Hidden Bodies next. Then after, like, something like, you know, it works out to being, like, because of cuts and edits of what, you know, and stuff like that, probably like 1200 pages to get two books. And I was like, now I want to write something else. And Providence was like, was so different from you, but for me similar, because it was like three people in a lot of pain and dealing with, you know, difficult romantic situations. And I wanted a little break from Joe, and it was so nice. I mean, nice is not the word. It was awesome to have this show come along and expose so many more people to the writing and make all the people that had already read the books like, okay, we want book three. And it was like, yay, now I'm ready to write it. So I get to write two more books, which I'm very excited about, one of which is almost done, but that's a dangerous phrase to use, you know?
Did you know when you first started putting the, you know, well, I was going to say pen to paper, but when you started typing in your notes, did you know how it was going to end for Joe?
Always. That was something I thought about a lot. Just, yeah, said something else, like, it was about that, about why, like, that the ending, in case for anyone who hasn't seen it, for me, it was required because of the nature of what this is about. Like, I knew that that was how it had to end, that that was kind of the point of it, that unfortunately, if you are, like, not looking out for yourself in this day and age, in a lot of days and age, you know, and throughout all time, and with men that are know that they can get away with things and know how to, and feel that their emotions are most important of all, and put the emotional responsibility for themselves on other people, it's one of the most terrifying things about this world. And I like to write about, for me, like, that reality, that, that, you know, it's a scary world out there.
The book has been praised up and down. Is there any negatives? Does anyone ever say, hey, I wish you, because everyone has to be like, you know, everyone thinks they're an armchair author now. Any negatives, like, oh, I wish you would have done this or that with the first two books?
Oh, of course. Yeah. Like, I'll hear.
What's the biggest one?
I feel like I'll hear that they wanted more of Beck's perspective, which for me, I get, especially when you watch the show. I mean, there's such different mediums that, like, in the show, it's one of the most exciting things for me to see, like, in season one, there are scenes with just Beck and her friends. And I'm like, yes, like, for television, for this adaptation of it and this mixtape of it, it works wonderfully. But in the books, you never leave Joe's perspective, because that's sort of the point of it, that he doesn't, you know, that it's all for him. It's all the Joe story. You know, he's the center of the universe. So I get where the show can activate a frustration in people that, like, well, wait a minute, in this book, you don't hear from her. And, you know,
my only,
and then, yeah, people will feel like it's, their books are nasty. And I'm like, yeah, like, that's the thing. Like, this is what goes on in his head. And
my only knock, I have to play my knock, is because I work in law enforcement. So I'm always like, oh, that's that crime scene. Joe left too sloppy of a crime scene. That's my only knock, because I'm watching, I'm like, that crime scene, too sloppy. He dropped the rock, or he did that.
Yeah.
Too much stuff there that he can be caught. That's all I think about.
Oh, yeah. I get it.
Hey, when did that call come? I love having athletes when they tell me, like, the moment they got the call, like, hey, you're getting drafted by the Knicks. When did that call come from Lifetime on Netflix? When did they reach out to you?
It's going to sound like all I do is go to the, like, to stores, but I was in a grocery store. And yeah, and I had a cart, and I just started shaking. And I just remember, like, my hands shaking, everything shaking. I remember the aisle I was in and everything. Like, it was like there was an earthquake inside of me, because it's just so, it's so surreal when you think of how many books and stories there are. And also that it was like, oh, it's Greg Berlanti and, you know, and Sarah Gamble. Like, these are, they make wonderful television and they love it. And it was very exciting. And then the exciting journey of, like, from, we started out at Showtime in development, and then to Lifetime, and then everyone at Lifetime was wonderful, but it was, you know, they were going to cancel it, basically. I mean, I think it was canceled, and then Netflix swooping in. So it's all been very dramatic in Hollywood and exciting in that way. And that's where it makes it all the sweeter to see it blow up like this, you know, because the, like, it's a really difficult business for everyone in that way, of when, like, things moving around. Yeah.
When you wrote You, were you living in Cape, or were you down? Did you ever live in New York City at all, or no?
I did. I lived in New York for like 5 years.
Okay.
I'm really bad at years. But yeah, I think from like 99 to 2002-3. And I've always, like, wherever I live, I always go back to the Cape. So, like, it's been a while for me right now at this particular time because of a lot of stuff going on here. Mm-hmm. But in 2013, I wrote most of it in LA. And it also came out of my romanticizing New York, because when you move away and you watch Sex and the City and, you know, Muppets Take Manhattan, and you're like, why did I leave? Like, New York is so fun and warm and easy. And I was absolutely romanticizing it. And so Beck working that out was kind of me trying to remember what it's really like. And I wrote, I finish the book on Cape Cod, like in November, December, over the holidays.
Oh, that's really interesting with Beck. Like, that's a really cool job. That's a good tidbit.
What's that?
I like that tidbit about Beck, like romanticizing New York. That was you speaking. That was really cool.
Yeah, because in that way, also for me, it was like I really writing advice always makes me feel squeamish. But I was just like, okay, you know what? I'm gonna put her in the apartment where I lived. She's gonna go to the corner bistro like I do. She's not me, but like I gave her a lot of my trappings and then a lot of like things that I would look back on, like, eek, did I do that? You know, and then, you know, exaggerate them, of course. And yeah, and that's where I was so happy. Like Elizabeth, I think, was just so wonderful and endearing. And yeah,
Book two
who
takes,
played Beck in the show? Yeah.
yes, book two takes place in LA, and
Yep.
I know you live out there, obviously, from your phone number, but what do you miss the most and the least about the Big Apple?
The most I miss walking around. Like I was just there last week for 2 days, and I could walk around New York City for the rest of my life. Like there's nothing like it. There's where you're just allowed to be like completely in your head and on the move. That magic is there's absolutely nothing like that. To me, when I was young and like with headphones on, listening to A Tribe Called Quest, electric relaxation on repeat at 3 o'clock in the morning, like walking home, feeling like so safe. And what I miss the least for sure is icicles and on my eyelashes and like that cold feeling, that unfun, unhallmark movie cold, where it's like that last February I was there and I was going to walk to the east, the Lower East Side. My friend's like, you're going to want to take an Uber. I'm like, no, I'm in New York. I want to walk. And I walk outside, like, yeah. Oh, that's right.
What food do you crave the most?
Bistro Burger lately, because people have been are tweeting pages of the book, and I feel like I've seen the phrase Bistro Burger twice this week, and I didn't make it down there when I was there, and it's been so long. And those fries that I remember, like telling vegetarian friends, like these are the best French fries. And my mom came once, and she was like, you know that these are made in bacon. I'm like, oh. And pizza, of course. I mean, New York pizza is another, like,
Of
you
course.
know,
What about bagels? Bagels is always my thing. Whenever I travel, I miss the bagels the most.
yeah. I feel like I overdid it on bagels in college, and then once in a while, like, ooh, a bagel. Like even here, I'll buy like, you know, inferior bagels in the grocery store, but just kind of it's back to English muffins. Yeah.
I asked you if you pinched yourself with the book, and now over 40 or 50 million people have seen this show you. So obviously those numbers, you can't even fathom those kind of numbers. But did you have anything to do with the show itself? Were you being on set? Were you asked for advice, talking with anyone? Were you there?
I'm a consulting producer, so they'll send me scripts and I'll read them and like react to them. And in season one, the timing was great. So I feel like I was in a good place with Providence with my draft of that. And I was able to, it was so nice of them to invite me into the room to write an episode. Like you don't see that on all shows with adaptations. And I got to be in the writer's room with the writers and do write an episode, and which was just a great experience and getting to know the wonderful people making the show. And I went to New York to visit the set. Of course, loved every second of that. Like there's nothing like walking down the street and a security guard's like, well, this is a film set here. I'm like, no, that's ours. Like I get to go there, you know, like and season two, it's like my own mini Game of Thrones where so excited about the show and they asked me to write another episode. But they were writing earlier this year, and it was like, I have to write the third book in a good way. And it was too much for me to be full that involved in the writing of the show and the book at the same time, because they're, you know, they're different worlds and just in the purity of like time constraints, you know.
You nailed the perfect thing.
But clearly they know what they're doing.
Yes, they do. But you just said some very interesting different worlds, because you know the second book and the season two definitely veered in separate ways. How was your mind not contaminated by that? Because you watched a show. How was your mind not contaminated to like, oh wow, was that in the book or was that in the
Oh, I watched the
show?
show. You know, it's like it's all work. Like I go, but like I used to be a TV writer, and I wrote for Seventh Heaven and Secret Life of the American Teenager, and I know what a different medium it is from working in that medium. And I also made a short film. I adapted a short story that I wrote and directed it. And I remember the in the beginning, I was like, this is so easy because I already wrote the story. I'm just gonna pop it into final draft and I'll have the script. And needless to say, not true at all. Like you, when you adapt your own work, you realize you learn such a lesson about just what different mediums they are, down to like you're working with actors and you're it's not just words, it's all of these elements coming together. And in that way, like, I have that perspective on it. So they're, in my mind, they're like two separate entities. And like Sarah said something great a few weeks ago, where like Book Joe and Show Joe are first cousins. And I'm like, I love that, because it's true. Like, I feel like the Book Joe works in the books, and there's Show Joe in the show. And yeah, like, that's the way to go to approach it.
We talked Beck, we talked Joe. I want to talk about you. Right before you came on, I did a quick Google search, and then I wrote two things on a Post-it, because everything on the internet's true. You know that.
Absolutely.
Two things popped up. One thing came up with South Park, and the other thing, Backstreet Boys. I didn't get to read the whole thing because I didn't want to be contaminated and be like, oh, so what'd you do with Matt Stone and Trey Parker? But what'd you do with South Park and the Backstreet Boys?
So with South Park, when I was in college, I did two independent studies. Well, I majored in, it's like, I went to Brown, and it's like the most Brown major you can have. It's called American Civilization, and there's only one requirement, and then you build your study. Like, you rationalize why all these courses go together. So mine was called My Notions of Normalcy in American Culture. And I did an independent study on South Park and race and eating disorders. And I wish that I have it. I feel like it's in my mom's house, like buried somewhere. But it's South Park was one of those things, when it came out, it blew my mind. I watched every episode, like, you know, so much. It just fascinated me, of like something that felt so fresh and of this moment and insightful and creative. And yeah, and I just wanted to like dissect it and why it was blowing up the way it was too. So that was South Park. And Backstreet Boys, I used to work for Tiger Beat.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Wow, okay.
Yes, in the magazine, all the writers that were there, like, they would call us like Associate Editor Caroline. And that job was just phenomenal. And that job, it always comes up when I do interviews, because it was one of those like moments in my early 20s where I had two job offers. And one was at Tiger Beat. And this was like at the peak of the Backstreet Boys, NSYNC, Britney, like when all of that was, you know, like larger than life. Ha ha ha. And the other job offer was at Condé Nast. And the little writer in me was like, oh my God, Condé Nast, the New Yorker, Vanity Fair. Like, you get into Condé Nast, it's like, it's an incredible inn. But it was a magazine that was about home decor and gardening. And I'm just not passionate about those things. And I chose Tiger Beat over Condé Nast. And I remember thinking, I might be making like the stupidest decision of my life. But it was like, this is what my life is. I'm going to go and make decisions that might be stupid, because I have to follow my little heart. And at that time, it was like, I couldn't stop listening to all of this music. And I just had to find out what it would be like to work at Tiger Beat.
Okay.
And so it was great.
I've had you on for 30 minutes. So we're going to do a few quick questions to finish up. Sound good?
Yep.
First time you saw someone reading your book, you did what?
Screamed.
Did you go up to them?
Yeah.
Did you? Wait, let me hear the story.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, it gets even better than that, because I went up to them. It was on a table. Okay, so technically they weren't reading, but it was sitting on a table in a bookstore, right? And I'm like, okay, I can't help it. I have to. And I'm like, oh, and I've also, it was so early in life, you know, and I'm like, oh my, like in my life as an author, and I'm like, I'm sorry, like, I just had to come up to you because I'm Caroline. I wrote this book, and this is like such a moment. And she's like, oh, that's so exciting. This book was here when I sat down.
Oh, she shattered you. Really?
Yes. Yep. I mean, and I'm like, that's what being an author boils down to, because there are so many books in the world, you know, like, it's, yeah, like, there's just so much. And it was this great moment of like, oh, that's right. Like, everyone's not going to be reading my book all the time, you know?
I had Eric Larson on, and we talked about the first time he saw someone. He said he was on the subway, actually, in New York, and someone's holding the book. And he's like, okay, I'm going to tell them that's me. I kept waiting. Yeah. He's like, it was 11 stops, and the guy never – he just held the book in his hand. So Eric's like, I didn't even go up to him. And he said it ruined his whole day. He wanted to be like, that book, that's me. He's like, but the guy didn't even acknowledge. He must have just been holding the book for whatever reason.
Yes. Oh my God. Yes. Yeah. I mean, it's a strange situation that way. Oh, and do you know Michael Osiello? He's a great writer. He had a book out, and I feel like it was out last year, and he posted a picture of someone reading it on a plane, and I'm like, love. And it was a long post, and I just like reacted right away. I was like, oh my God, like, this makes me so happy. And he was like, you have to read the whole thing. And he just posed the woman, like had her read it. I thought that was pretty brilliant. Yeah. Like,
you and I are at a bar in New York, and you want to impress people. Who's the coolest person in your phone that if you texted them, they would text you back?
Ooh. I mean, I'll go with the show and say John Stamos.
Oh, that's a really, really good answer.
Yes.
Well, then you know what? I think I know the answer might be Stephen King, but be a name dropper. Who's the coolest person? The coolest person that reached out to you because of the book or the show.
Yeah. I mean, I would say Stephen King, because for the book, like BJ Novak for the book, Lena Dunham for the book, like so many, like, yeah, it's such a nice thing because you writing is so isolating and, you know, it's months of who the hell knows what this is. So it's always really nice to like reach people whose work you admire too.
What book are you currently reading right now?
Right now, I am there's a book coming out today that I am obsessed with that I'll be talking to the author this week about, A Good Man by Ani Katz. Mm-hmm. That's just if you like you, you'll love it. Like, I love that book so much. And I just got this book, The Killer in Me by Olivia Kiernan. And I have Wonderland by Zoja Stage. I have like this whole mountain of books that I have to finish rewriting my book, and then I get to read those books. But it's this, there is a beautiful mountain.
Besides you, of course, favorite TV show?
Succession. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Succession. And I loved The Morning Show. And I love the show Younger.
Okay.
And yes. And as far as like I watched The Office a lot, like just over and over, and Sex and the City. And yeah, those are like my, oh, and oh my God, Watchmen, I loved this year.
Are you a book snob like Joe?
I'm not.
Not
but
one bit.
Well, I feel like we all have a little bit of that in us, like at times, but no, I just think it's such a waste of time. Reading, the thing about reading, like, You interact with a book. You bring yourself into it. And everyone interacts with books so differently. And like, there was just something great today. I think it was on, I don't know what website, but it was about how important horror is and how great it is if you've gone through a trauma and if you're going through a hard time. And I read this, like, I was just sitting there like, yes, screaming at every sentence, like, yes, yes, yes. Like, I don't like even the idea of genres. I understand the need for them for categories, but to me, like, reading is a mix between your brain and the written word. And there's like no reason to be snobby ever.
I have a bunch of true crime authors on, true crime podcast hosts on. And sometimes fans get a little weird with what they send them. Has anyone ever sent you anything weird?
Yeah, I've gotten some interesting things.
Give me one weird thing that you can say you got.
Panties that belong to Beck who doesn't exist in the real world.
Wait, as you're saying that, I'm like, oh, that's kind of weird, because who is she in real life? Okay, that's okay. You know what? That
right,
might win
the
weirdest
I mean.
Thing.
Like, okay, like, yeah. But it's mostly wonderful things. Like, I've gotten red ladles, you know, and people have made mugs of urine. Like, I know that sounds weird, but I'm like, yeah.
And I think you know the answer because you are the star of it. But you, the neighbor, are you getting a hoot out of, like, everyone who's thinking who the neighbor is at the end of season 2?
Oh, yeah. I mean, this is like, I'm such a like pop culture person. I love, this is my favorite thing about technology, that like there's the ability to have these giant like book clubs, TV clubs, where everyone gets to play together. Like, that's the stuff that I wish existed when I was a kid and I was obsessed with things. Like, what a wonderful thing for everyone to get to share their theories and obsess and analyze every little frame. I mean, I love that so much. Like, so much fun.
After we finish up, just text me who it is so I can. I won't let anybody know.
Yeah. I like that you think that I know.
Don't ruin the secret. I think you have it all planned out. Like, you're from Homeland, Carrie from Homeland. You have everything laid out on the wall, nice and neat. You have every star. You know exactly what's going to happen. I have faith in you.
Yes. And oh my God, Homeland is one of my other favorite shows. I love it.
I love it.
It's coming back soon.
You know what? I never watched Sopranos, and I had a long, long flight like a month ago, and I started watching it. So I just caught up to it. I have 4 episodes left. You ever watch Sopranos?
I loved it so much, and I'm jealous of you that you're getting to like watch it for the first time now. It was when I worked at Entertainment Weekly, mm-hmm. It was my first assignment. I went to a Sopranos wrap party, or like a Sopranos premiere party, and that was such a thrill. I loved it so much. And then I went on the Sopranos bus tour, and this was funny, where like they drop us off at the strip club from the show.
Okay, in Jersey, right?
Yeah, and we all have cameras, okay? And it's like also like it's, you know, like the year 2000 or 2001, whatever it is. And we all look like tourists, and my mom was with me. And we all walked into the strip club that says no cameras in the middle of the day, and everyone's like taking their pictures in the strip club. Just amazing.
Every guest I have on, I'm not a memorabilia person. The only piece of memorabilia I have in my house is like two seats from Yankee Stadium. But everyone who comes on my show, I have to send something and get something signed. So afterwards, I'll send you a book and you have to sign it for me so I can put it on my display wall. Sound good?
I can do that. Yes.
Mm-hmm. This was an absolute blast. I've been dying to do this. And thank you. I know I was very persistent. After I read the first book, I was on vacation and I read the book. I'm like, I have to find out who this author is. I have to email her. You wrote right back. And true to your word, you came on. I can't thank you enough. And you are an amazing author. I can't wait for book number three.
Well, so happy to do it. This was so much fun. And I really appreciate your being cool with the, like, can we do it this day, that day? Yes.
Anything for you. Listen, I cannot wait. Text me who Neighbor 3 is. I cannot wait for the next book and we'll keep in touch.
Thank you, Michael, so much.
You are the greatest. Thank you so much.
You too. Okay. Bye-bye.